This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanesan. Demonstrations in Hong Kong, protests in Bangkok, and insurgency in Washington, D.C. What do they all have in common? Anger. Public anger. While economists tell us that the human race has never been richer, on the ground it feels like people are only getting progressively more stressed, anxious, and angry. The key question here is why? Well, Angrynomics posits that the root cause of all this increased populism and polarization comes down to wealth and income inequality, anger that is boiled over with nowhere else to go. So at what point does economics become Angrynomics, and can we reverse that? Well, to find out, I speak with Mark Blythe, co-author of Angrynomics and professor of international economics and director of the Rhodes Center of International Economics and Finance at Brown University. Mark, first thing, welcome to The Breakfast Grill.
Oh, it's very nice to be with you.
Mark, when does economics become Angrynomics? Will you just break that down for us?
Sure. When the majority of people in a country no longer believe that the economy of that country works for them. It's a very simple way of thinking about it. And many, many countries, despite, as you know, being on average richer than we've ever been, certainly seem to the majority of people to not be working for them.
Yeah, I often hear this joke. If Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk walked into a restaurant, immediately everyone is an average billionaire, right? That's how the GDP per capita works. Just because the GDP per capita has increased, that doesn't mean the wealth has been distributed across the board here. And when we talk, your book really does address a lot of this, and I do want to get into all of, especially the solutions in just a bit, but we have to go through some of the key concepts here. Particularly, let's start with the two major types of anger you describe: public anger, which is either tribal or moral outrage, and then we have private anger. How do these different angers manifest on the ground?
Okay, so let's think about what's been going on in American politics for the past year. So in the summer, we had the Black Lives Matter protests breaking out. Now, if you think about those protests, what are they based upon? They're based upon the fact that there are historic wrongs that need to be righted, that oppression which should have been removed is still there. Cornel West went on CNN, and your listeners can go on YouTube and find this. He went on CNN at the time of these protests breaking out and said, what does it say of us as a people, and what would it say of our country if we were not outraged at what's going on? Right, so it's a claim to moral righteousness that something is deeply wrong and it needs to be addressed. Now, that can be positive or negative in the way that that is addressed. If you want to see a negative way, think about the events of January the 6th and the storming of the Capitol. There you have a bunch of people who are also making moral claims. The election was stolen, right? That we have been wronged in some way. But this has been weaponized by politicians and by social media and other forces to basically create a kind of tribalism. Now, let me explain what I mean by that. The notion of this came to Eric, my co-author, and I when we went to a soccer match in Britain. So we went to watch Watford versus Everton. Now, I don't know if your listeners follow the English Premier League.
We do.
You will know
Malaysians.
This is right. Yeah, I know you guys do, right? And you will know that that's going to be a crap match, right? So we wondered, why do people spend lots of money and lots of time in terrible weather conditions going to watch really crap football matches? And why is it that the most committed fans, because we were down amongst them in the Watford end, even though I'm an Everton fan, they were absolutely furious about what's going on. And what's interesting is they don't actually put their anger on the opposition fans. They don't even really harass the ref that much or their own players. It's the other fans. What they're doing is they're reinforcing an identity. You're not loyal enough. You're not showing your true colours. You need to be with us in this fight. They're a kind of moral regulator. And that's what politics weaponizes when it takes that moral outrage and pushes it into a particular direction. Now, just finishing this off and we'll move on. Private anger. What we got concerned with there is Eric used to be a labour economist. That's what he's trained as. And he says, you know, 20 years ago when I'm doing all these models and equations and we're talking about optimizing this and flexibilizing that, not once did anyone mention the people who actually make up these labour markets. And that's kind of the intuition behind this whole thing, that when you deregulate product markets and labour markets, you get lots of benefits in the aggregate, but you also increase the fragility of people's incomes. You also give more to capital and less to labour. You create platforms whereby people are doing a kind of 19th century piecework in a digital economy. You create unbelievable stresses for single parents because they don't have control of their hours anymore. So it's all of these changes, which in a sense are meant to make us richer, have actually stressed us out and made us mentally and physically poorer. So if that's the micro side, add that to those macro sides, those macro complaints, and the two of them will energize each other.
Now, let's talk about the three versions of capitalism that you explore in the book and what essentially led to their respective ends.
Yeah, sure. So the way, let me explain to your listeners the way this came about. So I had to come up with a way of talking to tech people about economics. And this is what I came up with. So the analogy is, imagine that capitalism at any point in time is like a laptop computer. These computers have different configurations of the hardware, but they all have common bits of hardware. So do economies. They all have labor markets, they all have product markets, that sort of stuff. And any given configuration of hardware in any epoch, any historical moment, has certain ideas that govern it. Right? So that's a software. Now, just like computers, as this hardware grows in complexity and ages and new bits are bolted on and the software gets a little bit sort of like degraded and no longer quite works, you get bugs in the system. And those bugs are what cause system crashes. And a big system crash is when you need to not just reboot the software, you have to rebuild the hardware. And we've done this three times over the history of capitalism. The first time was essentially the gold standard. Open economies, money tied to gold, free flows of people. And the problem with this one was, for reasons which we go into the book, I won't go into here, you just trust me on this one, is that labor doesn't like this. A short version is, imagine a world in which every country is trying to export and nobody wants to import. What's going to happen? Too much stuff. What then happens? Prices go down, so wages go down, so everyone gets angry, right? That was resolved, quote unquote, with a big system crash called World War I and the Great Depression. Not wanting to do this again, we rebuilt the computer in 1945. This was the Bretton Woods system. Closed national economies, a full employment mandate, high taxes and transfers, Fordist mass production as the growth engine. And the software that governed that was very different. This is Keynesian economics, right? Now, the problem with this, the bug in the software was brutally exposed in the 1970s, which was inflation. Because if you keep running full employment as a target, you end up with super hot labor markets, and eventually you're going to outstrip the ability to pay very high wages all the time through increasing productivity. There's going to be a disconnect. And when that disconnect happens, profits fall, and the people in business go, to hell with this, I don't want to do this anymore, and you get Reagan and Thatcher. That's the people who rewrite the new software. We retool the hardware. This is when you get independent central banks. This is when you get the so-called neoliberal move in economics. And we move into this globalized world, which has been incredible for many parts of the world, particularly Asia and Southeast Asia, right? But has been less good for the working classes of those core countries. And they are the people who are now involved in that populist backlash, because for them, they don't care about the fact that Malaysia's been growing or China's been growing. They care about the fact that they haven't been growing. Right. So what happens instead is, rather than rebooting the software, we build up a bunch of hardware. We build up a bunch of software problems. And those are manifest in the global financial crisis in 2008. Basically, massive inequality papered over with lots of credit and a hugely overlevered banking system. That goes bang. Now, what should have happened is a fundamental reset, a rebuild of the computer, a whole new set of ideas. But we didn't. We turned around to the global central banks and said, please bail us out. And they chucked trillions of dollars in yen and everything else into the global economy, oddly without producing any inflation at all anywhere. And COVID has done the same thing. And what we did was we papered over the cracks. Now, what is populism? Populists are kind of the rogue code writers. They're trying to hack a new software because they know that the hardware's busted. And the people in charge of the hardware refuse to actually change it because it benefits the people they really care about, which is the top 20% of the income distribution. So that's how we think about it in the book in terms of macro crashes, producing macro angrynomics.
So right now, we're still in version 3.0, which is a patched up version of the software, as you put it. And what needs to change, Mark, I guess, in this situation? Because I think you noted in the book, or was it your co-author, Eric, that essentially what we saw in the GFC was socialism for the banks and the rich, but capitalism for the poor. What is the solution here? What should have changed during the GFC?
Well, the first thing would be to basically change the overall stance of the economy to benefit wage earners rather than companies. The 70s may have gone too far in the other direction, but by the time that we got to the 2000s, it had gone massively the other way. There was a report from a team at the University of Amsterdam, in, I think at the end of 2019, that estimated that around 40% of global FDI is nothing but tax dodging. So essentially, we've managed to create global capitalism that's highly profitable for the people who hold shares in those companies, etc. But much of it is based on nothing more than tax avoidance. And if those taxes aren't being paid, then ultimately, what do you have? You have a lot of need in those economies that's not being met, right? Second thing, there was a study by the RAND Institute, which is hardly a sort of left liberal institute, just a few months ago. You can get all this off my Twitter feed if you want to go look for it, at MK Blythe. And those folks looked at America and said, what would have happened if you went back to 1980 and you didn't do any of the tax cuts? And you didn't do any of the regulatory changes, where would we be now? Your average person would be about between $11,000 and $17,000 a year better off. And inequality would be more or less half of what it is now. So just recognizing that as being real and being a problem, then we can talk about the various solutions to this.
And we will get into some of the solutions in just a bit, Mark. One of the solutions is a national wealth fund, essentially to make citizens owners of capital markets there. You've been listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanison for BFM 89.9.
You are listening to The BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanison. This morning, I'm speaking with Mark Blythe, co-author of Engrainomics and director of the Rhodes Center for International Economics and Finance at Brown University. So, Mark, when I take a look at your book, I like the fact that the focus was on effective solutions as opposed to finding optimal ones. You know, what's the best case scenario? How do we tax global wealth across the world? Because these are things that are non-starters. You know, no politician's going to go after this. And from an operational standpoint, it's very difficult to do. Instead, you propose, at the risk of oversimplification here, a three-pronged plan to save the world and make everyone less angry. The first one, I mentioned it earlier, is the utilization of a national wealth fund to essentially make citizens shareholders. Explain to us how this tackles inequality. Are we talking about something like Norway's fund over there?
Or even the ones that you have in Malaysia? No, we're talking about something that's a bit different from that. And here's how it works and why it's different. So taxpayers ultimately pay for the mistakes of the financial sector. The financial sector's customers are people who have financial assets, which is, again, our friends in the top 20%. So basically, 80% bail 20%. That's not fair, and that makes people angry. So we know now that whenever there's a big financial crisis, and we tend to have them every 10 years, so 2008, COVID, right, you know, equity markets lose about 50% of their value. And what happens is central banks and treasuries run in and go, don't worry, we've got your back, you're fine. And they basically chuck money at the problem, put a floor under prices, and then it's fine. Now, under COVID in America, we call this the K-shaped recovery. Because the leg of the K is everyone who's got assets that's on a protected list from the Fed, which means you're fine, just keep buying. And everyone who doesn't have assets, who just earns wages, is, I'm sorry, you're totally out of luck. And that's not good either. So what we propose is, next time this happens, why don't we have a fund in place that has a line of credit from the central bank that takes the central bank's credit and basically uses it to buy all those equities that have fallen by 50%. And next time, we don't give them back. We just keep them. And then we stabilize markets, right? Do all the usual liquidity support, whatever, right? But we get to keep the equity. Then we run it as a totally professionally managed passive fund, miles away from any politicians, whose rules are written up by a kind of mini-public. What you want is basically industry people who understand how finance works, who can give you the best returns. You want members of the public. You want members of social organizations, churches, etc. And you get them to write the constitution, and you keep it very simple. What you want to do is say, every Malaysian who's a resident who has one of these citizens' wealth funds, after 10, 15 years of running this thing, not only will you have all of those equities that have come back in value, they increase it around 5 to 6% a year. So imagine that you buy a huge amount of equities. Let's say you issue 20% of GDP in bonds, which we now know we can do because of COVID. You bought all those equities. You put them in a passive fund. It could literally be worth hundreds of billions of dollars in a 5 to 10 year period. Then keep it simple. Every resident Malaysian citizen on their 21st birthday gets an endowment. right? You're not allowed to go party with it. There's an approved list of what you can do, but it's yours. That's it. That's your start in life. Go do it. That would make an enormous difference in people's lives, particularly for the bottom 50, 60%. What it also does is it actually makes us the owners of capitalism.
Yeah.
Right? This is what the supporters of capitalism have wanted forever. Well, here's a solution, right? I can make everybody an owner. Isn't that good? Because then they got skin in the game. Then they actually have to care about those returns. We all, for once, get on the same page. So it's not just about the money. It's not just about the fact you can use this to refinance education, healthcare, inequality, a green transition, whatever you like. It's about the fact that it makes you part of something bigger.
Yeah, I like referring to this as a socialistic capitalism among friends, because essentially in Malaysia, we have a few versions of this, right? We have not the sovereign wealth fund, but we have a pension fund called EPF, which invests heavily in the Malaysian market. But predominantly, its strategic asset allocation is locally focused, and there's a lot of fixed income in there. I'm guessing in your national wealth fund proposal, is it entirely based on equities that have fallen? Like, say, last year when the equity market fell, remember what was it, 30, 40%?
The strategy is essentially Abu Dhabi. We want to have a quarter of 1% of everything that doesn't, the everything that moves, right, or everything that sells. You want to have maximum diversification in this, so that if something has a downside, something else has an upside. Right, that's basically it.
Yeah, and I guess the risk component here is slightly muted because of the fact that you're buying diversified and it's passive, right? You're just going across the board, buying everything. This company fails, this company fails. But it's also a kind of, not a riff, but a parallel to what central banks are doing right now by backstopping bond and capital markets.
One way to think about this is that this is quantitative easing for the people.
Now, I want to quickly touch on the data dividend that you've also proposed in the book here. How does this work then? Like, on a practical level, how do we get this through?
So let's be clear about what we're saying. Here's your problem. I think at this point in time, it's something like 30 or 40% of the S&P are Google, Apple, Amazon, et cetera, right? It's going to be hard to tax these types of firms. So what do you do instead? Well, one way to do it is to remember that their profit engine is data. The platform is just to get you to log on, right? The fact that your grandma can get to see pictures is purely coincidental to the fact that they want all of the keystrokes, because that's what they're monetizing. So essentially, you have a property right. You are individually a data generator. Now, the analogy is this. Imagine mobile phones. Every time we open up a new G, we basically flog off a bit of the sky and we charge companies for a 25-year lease of 5G or whatever it happens to be, literally hundreds of billions of dollars to do this, right? And yet we give away our data for free. That's crazy. So a very simple thing to do would be just to get everyone to opt in or opt out and say, if you want to opt in, what we're going to do is we're going to calculate a kind of average fee per user. We're going to look at, you know, how much we can negotiate from these companies from this. And then you use their platforms. That's great. If you don't want to do that, you have to start paying for the platforms. Right? You can totally like not sign up to this. That's fine. But it's in your interest to do so, because otherwise we're going to insist that you start paying for the platforms, because this is not free. And also it is weaponizing anger in our politics and we don't like it. So it's a way of kind of addressing that problem and the revenue problem simultaneously. A carrot and a stick.
So how do we start this process then? Looking at the National Wealth Fund and this data dividend, what's the next step here? Yes, we're seeing a lot of anger. Politicians are looking for solutions. The Biden administration is going to spend a lot of money. What's the next step to make the two prongs here a reality?
Well, again, let's go back to our analogy about hardware and software and think about populists of various stripes as the kind of rogue code writers of the era. There's some of that code is nasty and pernicious and nationalistic and racist, and we don't want to go very much near it. But there's other parts of it which are really useful. And for many of these sort of OECD countries, particularly the ones in Western Europe, a lot of those party systems that kept the system as it was in 3.0 have kind of fallen apart. And it's very much up for grabs now which way they go. Italy is a classic case of this, right? If you take the two fascist parties, and one of them really is an overt fascist party, the Fratelli, right? The Brotherhood of Italy. They almost have a majority, which is pretty scary, right? On the other hand, the fastest growing political party in Germany, which has replaced the Social Democrats, are the Greens. And the Greens are all over this stuff. Right, they get it, because they look at the Citizens' Wealth Fund as not just a sort of a way to do something on inequality. It's a way to finance a decarbonisation.
Yeah.
Right? They look at digital giants and surveillance capitalism and go, no, sorry, we're not into this stuff. Like, we're going to have to renegotiate this deal, right? So they don't seem particularly radical, but actually what they're doing is quite fundamental. And I think that those forces are driving politics, particularly amongst younger people, amongst younger voters, right across the world.
Mark, I've got one last question here, and it's the third prong of your proposal. So the proposal is a flexible fiscal rule, which turns low interest rates to our advantage. So instead of worrying about debt to GDP ratios, you propose expanding borrowing when the cost is below GDP growth, but on the flip side, raise taxes when interest rates are higher. I guess, why do this?
Because it makes sense. It makes basically fighting recessions automatic. It also means that you don't overshoot or undershoot when you're doing your budgeting. It becomes a very simple automatic rule. Whenever you can afford to use debt, use it. When your economy slows down so that basically the cost of service and the debt is rising faster than the rate of growth in the economy, then you go for taxes, right? And you just flip. Right, so different countries will have different combinations. Some countries will actually always be able, in a sense, to issue debt of their high growth economies. And that's fine because that's what investors want to hold. They're buying your future stock of assets, in a sense, by lending you money. And if you're a country that needs to basically cut down its use of debt, that means that you need to reapportion your tax burden. So just do it. So it's a very simple way of taking, if you will, the partisan sting out of both taxes and debt, because it basically puts it on a simple, kind of almost arithmetic rule, right, that makes sense for running an economy without running into trouble. So, you know, two quotes that sort of sum this up. One was Oliver Wendell Holmes, taxes are the price of civilization, right? That's why we have taxes, right? And then the other one in terms of debt, right? People forget this one, that someone's debt is someone else's asset. So when people say, you know, I actually do this occasionally. I give talks every now and again to the U.S. Navy. And I went into a room full of both bureaucrats and officers and said, ladies and gentlemen, if you could reduce the national debt of the United States by 50% at the stroke of a pen, would you do it? And every single one of them said, yes, sir, immediately we'd do that. I said, congratulations, you've just destroyed half of national savings because it's the same thing.
The bonds, right?
Yeah. Right, exactly. And we need to recognize this. And once you recognize this, that type of flexible fiscal budgeting, but an automatic version of it, completely makes sense.
Last one, Mark, very quickly here. When we talk about consumption, one of the things that I find is really interesting, you argue for central banks to be given powers to transfer cash directly to households instead of cutting rates or backstopping the markets, right? And now I understand the appeal here, but why not leave that to the governments? Why give that power to central banks?
Mainly because at the time we were writing this, this was when politicians were afraid of their own fiscal shadow. And I think that COVID has certainly proven that when it comes to it, they can do this if needed. So that's less of a pressing concern now. But it would still be good to basically do it automatically, even if it was from the Treasury rather than from the central bank. And there are proposals now which are moving ahead and also real efforts to do this. So China, for example, is really far along in terms of a central bank digital currency. Sweden's not far behind them. The EU's thinking about that. There's even a proposal for a digital greenback, which is in the Fed and has been seriously looked at. Because the problem with QE, the way I used to describe quantitative easing as a strategy for basically recovery or stabilizing markets, is it's a bit like making a cup of tea with a fire hose and then filling up the whole house with water, and you'll be okay so long as you leave the lid off the kettle, right? You will eventually get something in it, but it's massively distorting and hugely expensive. It's really much simpler just to go, all right, so what would be the minimum cost we could do that would keep people in housing, food, and pay their utilities and not get them into trouble? Right. Okay. So it's 800, whatever a month. Okay. Yeah. We're just going to do 800 a month until the recession's over. And then when we recover, we can raise taxes if we need to. Done. The weird thing is it's cheaper in the long run.
Mark, there's so much we could talk about here. If I had more time, I would love to explore all of this. Like you talked about dual interest rates in the book as well, and basically how to end recessions forever, how to tap into the green economy and basically make that a reality. But people are just going to have to read the book to find out all about all those things. And I do highly encourage everyone, check out Angrynomics. It's a relatable, refreshing look at economics and the undercurrents that we're facing today. On that note, Mark, thank you so much for joining me today.
That's been a real pleasure. Thanks for the conversation.
I was speaking with Mark Blyth, co-author of Angrynomics and the director of the Rhodes Center for International Economics and Finance at Brown University. And you've been listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanasin for BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.